Grant, and I'm going to be facilitating the forum this evening, which is entitled "Toward a Sexual Ethics for Single Ethic for Singles." And I've asked some folks to help me with this. They will help me with the introduction. My role here this evening will be that of timekeeper. I'll keep you all on your toes. We will go until 10 o'clock, and folks are welcome to stay beyond that point, knowing that at 10:15 we will be having Compline service in this room. But if you want to continue the conversation beyond 10:15, you need to leave this space, or maybe we'll be done before 10, who knows. I will also be keeping my eye out for people that might like to say something. So if you would like to say something, I'm the person to kind of bat a hand at, or your eyelash. I'll warn you that even if you move your eyebrows, I'll call on you. I'm real good at seeing things from afar. I'm farsighted, so that will be my role this evening. I want to just lay some groundwork that forums at Holden Village are an opportunity for people to be in conversation with one another. It's an opportunity to hear varying opinions, and we request that people be open to listening to a variety of opinions and open to sharing their opinion, even though they might feel it might be divergent from the rest of the community gathered here. We do encourage a milieu of acceptance and openness, and hope that you can be part of that. It's an opportunity for all of us to clarify our opinions and to do that either verbally or not. So I hope, I'm eager for a good conversation together tonight. Before we start, I want to just tell folks that if they would like to take one of these newspapers, you're welcome to them. It's the latest issue of the Single Speak, which is a publication of the ELCA, specifically for single people. There's a place on here where you could get on the mailing list if you want to do that, so you're welcome to help yourself to those. Before we get into the specific topic of the evening, I would like you to meet one other person. Try to turn to somebody that you don't already know very well. Find out their name, and I would like you to tell each other one specific or general topic that you would like to hear addressed this evening, related to this topic. Okay? Meet one other person. You've met another person and you've committed to something you'd like to hear talking tonight to, at least in public, at least to one other person. You don't need to say it out loud to anybody else, but at least one other person kind of knows what you'd like to hear about and maybe might encourage you to raise an issue or a question here tonight. The title, I've said several times this week, that I believe that the highest form of compliment is the same thing as plagiarism. And so I've stolen the title for this forum this evening from an article by a woman named Dr. Karen Labatz. She's a professor at the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, California. And we, several of us, have had the opportunity to discuss the article that she wrote by this title. And I've asked some of the folks that were part of that discussion to make some introductory comments tonight. But as we begin, I'd like to read just a paragraph or so from the article that kind of set off our conversation this afternoon. She's referring to the Genesis text that reads, "And the man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame." Genesis 2:25. In ancient Hebrew, nakedness is a metaphor for vulnerability, and feeling no shame is a metaphor for appropriateness. We can therefore retranslate the passage as follows: "And the man and his wife experienced appropriate vulnerability." As a summation and closure to the creation story that precedes it, the line tells us that the net result of sexual encounter, the purposes of the creation of man and woman as sexual beings who unite with others to form one flesh, is that there be appropriate vulnerability. That's the paragraph I'm going to start out with, and I'm going to ask the four people that agreed to speak briefly talk just briefly now, and I will introduce them one at a time. We'll let them speak, and then we'll open it up to the entire group. Holly Ines is from Minneapolis, and she works at Augsburg Publishing House there. She's a graduate of St. Olaf College in 1986. Holly.
Well, I guess the first question that sort of comes to mind when talking about a sexual ethic, for me anyway, is sort of the question, is sex outside of marriage wrong, or is it okay? Now, for me, I was raised to believe that it's wrong, that sex is something you save for marriage, and that's something I really never questioned a whole lot. It's really ingrained in me. It's hard for me to even think, even though I have a lot of friends that I know, you know, have had sex outside of marriage, and I know it goes on a lot, I still feel that for me, that would be a hard thing for me to do. And yet, reading this article, there was one line I wanted to share. Neither Catholic nor Protestant tradition provides a totally satisfactory explanation for why sexuality should be fully expressed only in marriage. So this writer seems to think that there is no biblical precedent or, you know, anything straightforward in the Bible that says you shall not have sex until you marry. Well, then I went to the Bible, and in Mark 7, verse 21, let me share this verse with you. For from within, out of the heart, come evil thoughts, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. Well, fornication, which is among that list, according to Webster's definition, is sex outside of marriage. So I guess then, if you're looking at the definition that way, then it's pretty clear that that is defiling to a person and therefore should not be done. But then on the other hand, James Nelson, in his book Embodiment, which is a book on human sexuality, suggests that sex outside of marriage, if it's between two people who love and care about each other, have respect for each other, may actually be more moral than sex within a marriage if it's between two people who don't love each other, who do not respect one another, who do not care for one another. And that's, wow, that's, I guess I have to agree with that, you know? But then I think just because sex is sometimes misused within marriage doesn't necessarily mean it's okay outside of marriage, you know, even under the best of circumstances. So I just really struggle with looking at both sides of that. And I think another thing that is making this topic sort of a hot issue today is just that people are waiting longer to get married. You know, a few generations ago, people got married at age 18 and didn't have a lot of time to have frustrated sex drives. You know, they were married and they could express that and it was okay. Well, now people are 28, 30, 35 before they get married, and we're told by the church to repress that until you're 35, until you're married. And that makes it kind of hard. And then another thing, too, with so many, with divorce being as high as it is, you know, people who are married for 20 years have a very, you know, presumably active sex life, and then all of a sudden they have nothing anymore. And where do you get that affection then? Our society is not a real affectionate society. Here at Holden, it's probably more so than in the real world, so to speak, you know, a little more hugging and touching and stuff. But, you know, to say again to someone who's really grown accustomed to that and then really misses it when it's gone, that no, you can't have this again unless you get married again, well, that person may be real hesitant to jump into something that obviously didn't work out before. So I guess I'm not here to say one way or the other. I just wanted to present sort of why it is such a difficult area, such a gray area. And I'm hoping some other people that are going to be talking will be able to shed a little more light on it. And then maybe when we all discuss this later, too.
Great. Thanks, Holly. Frank Lulin. He's from Phoenix, Arizona. He's a lifelong member of a Lutheran church there and has been a longtime member of Lutherans Concerned for Lesbian and Gay Understanding. Frank?
Hi. I'm going to give a little background on myself. I've known since I was in grade school that I was gay. Of course, back then I didn't have any idea what that was or even knew a term for the feelings I had back then. But I realized that somehow I was different back when I was 12 years old or so. It's been a long, hard struggle over the years to integrate that aspect of my being with being a church person, being a Christian, and how to be responsible. Well, first of all, to know for sure that that was what I was. I spent many uncomfortable years praying, sometimes crying myself to sleep at night, asking God to change me. That didn't happen. I truly believe that sometimes we don't ask for what God has in mind for us. Sometimes not easy to accept that. After many years of struggle, I have come to accept myself as a gay person. Now, what that means sexually is somewhat difficult in light of the most churches' teachings, certainly the Lutheran Church teaching, that sex outside of marriage is wrong. It makes it very difficult for me because the Lutheran Church and most churches don't give me an option as to how I can express that sexuality properly. There is no proper way for me as a gay person to be sexual. I have been in relationship with one other person in my life. That was a very meaningful time to me, a very powerful experience. I went into that experience fully intending for that to be a lifelong commitment to that other person. That other person did not evidently feel as strongly as I did about it, and left. I am at this point still searching to find someone else. The separation between him and myself was a very emotional time, a very moving time. I was pretty much a basket case for several weeks following that breakup. Since that time, I should maybe say also that I am open with my family, with people at my church, and with people who I work with. Those times have basically been pretty good times for me. I've gotten pretty positive feedback. I'm one of the fortunate people. A lot of people who are gay don't have that kind of response. They get thrown out of houses by their parents who don't understand and will not accept. They are denied communion in their churches. They are told they cannot teach Sunday school classes because of irrational fears of what they might do with the children in the Sunday school classes. I guess at times I've been very angry at the church for the way in which they have treated not necessarily so much me, but my lesbian and gay sisters and brothers. I had a discussion with my pastor, who I also need to mention is a very supportive person. I had a discussion with him back a few months ago, and I told him that at some point, when I find the right person in my life, that I want the church to bless that relationship. my pastor suggested that, well, maybe what you could do is you could have a house blessing. I said, no, I don't think I could have a house blessing. I said, at this congregation in the past, we have had pet blessings. We have blessed people's relationships between their pets and themselves. And I said, I find it totally unacceptable for the church to then turn around and tell me that it will not bless a relationship which I intend to be a lifelong commitment between myself and another person. He's working on that. We'll see what happens. I've not totally given up on the church. There's times when I want to throw up my hands in despair and leave. But the church is very important to me. And I hope that in some way their current views can be reconciled with my views and with the views of a growing number of people and both lay and clergy within the church, I believe. A lot of gay people have left the church over the years because of things such as this, and I think it's a tragedy. I think it's an absolute shame. Something that should never happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Di Harris is a member of the Holden community and has lived here for almost a year now. She will be the head of Narnia this summer.
Hello. I'm going to try to stay on track at 4:00. First, when this subject first came up, I thought that, I remember when I was 16, I decided intellectually that I was going to have sex before I got married because I didn't want my husband to teach me all that I was going to know all my life. And I wanted to go into that relationship on an equal basis. I remember that quite vividly. And while I didn't have sex for a few years, I remember that was something I felt very strongly about. This afternoon I talked about my sister and I, coming from the same family. She made the opposite choice that I made. And I had known, I guess late in college, that she had decided to wait until she got married to have sex. And we went along, and finally at about age 25, we somehow sat down and were talking about that one day. And it was a really good discussion. I think we shared a lot of stories, and what I really learned from her is that I thought I was having a lot of pain with my choice, and I thought she had the easy road to follow. And I thought, boy, that would have been an easy road, just to wait till you get married. And I discovered how painful, through her stories, it was to make this choice, in that when she would go out with people, they would drop her because she would not have sex with them. And there's a lot of pain involved, somebody rejecting you for that reason. And I shared my pain with her, and it was a really good time for us and for me to see that either choice had its joys and sorrows. Since coming to Holden, and before Holden, but since being here, I can't deny that it's this Christian influence, even though I was brought up a Christian, that has really strengthened the relationship I have with God, and in that there's been a strengthening of how I feel about my sexuality. I always valued it before, but I now hold it to be a very sacred thing and something that I'd really want to share with somebody who's committed. And I don't know, all the joy that sacredness and holiness carries with it. I found that at Holden, no one has ever told me how I should behave sexually. Not everyone may feel that way who lives here, but I never read anything. I never heard anything. I never even heard anything through the grapevine. What I received here was a lot of love and acceptance and talk about spirituality. And so I guess indirectly, things have changed for me. I guess lastly, with that example, the only question I have as a Christian for the church is, why do we have a sexual ethic? And why do we have such strong rules and what seem to be directions geared towards children and I guess I need to say that I left the church because when I chose to have sex, I felt that I was tainted and I was going to hurt this pure church that I had grown up in. And so I left. And in leaving the church, somehow I left God too, and it took a while to get reconnected with that part. And I guess how I see the church is I wish that the church could be there and take off its mask and say, yes, I have those feelings too, and here's how I deal with them in my life, instead of saying, you can't have sex before marriage, or we don't recommend you have sex before marriage. So that unity of bringing, I guess I thought after we talked of the embracing of the contraries and the treasure of earthen vessels, I guess I see sexuality as a real treasure, and yet it's full of contraries. So that's it.
Thank you. Howard Pitts is a retired United Methodist pastor. I'd like to share some things.
I think I have, at age 70, the problems that most of us have with this whole subject. I'm a little fearful tonight lest young people go away either saying the church doesn't know right from wrong, or those people are certainly mixed up, or how do we know what to believe? They tell us one thing, now they're telling us something else. And I'm finding it difficult. In fact, the older I get, the harder this question becomes for me. Part of our problem, I believe, is not only that we haven't found ourselves as sexual beings and know who we are and feel good about ourselves, but we're so confused about this. Not just young people, but old folks are confused about this. And the exceptions are those people who have had the ideal marriage or something close to it. And they many times see this as a very simple thing. But for those of us who are single, it isn't nearly so simple. One point I'd like to make is that any Christian ethic is something less than Christian if it's just reduced to a set of rules. The Christian gospel brings us the Christ Spirit, and the Christ Spirit guides our actions, our living, our relationships. And when this is true, then we have a reverence for every person. And when we enter into a relationship with this in our heart, in our mind, then something very good can come out of it. And what level of sexual intimacy is not as important to me as whether we're in the spirit. Let me click off a few things I think I've learned. Sex is not evil in itself. As a child, I felt it was. I thought it was. I was taught it was. In fact, the worst thing in the world that a person could do is the sex act. That's the way I was taught. I learned that at the age of 5. And at the age of 8 or 10, I know you young people are smiling because you must be taught differently, but anyway, at the age of 8 or 10, I learned that that's how babies came. And I was utterly shocked. I could not believe it. It's a wonder I didn't have a stroke. I'm quite serious. Next, sex can be evil, can be destructive, terribly destructive. In fact, the popular sex ethic that we are taught all the time on television says, if it feels good, it's okay, which reduces it to a mechanical thing without meaning, and reduces the other person to something less than a relationship, less than a reverence for persons, less than a child of God. I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying the church needs to help children and youth by teaching the basics both of singleness and of marriage. How to be one person, how to couple. And the church needs to find a way to do this. Instead of trying to do it with a set of taboos or rules, help young people find meaning in marriage and help them find relationships with other young people. By itself, the vow to virginity may not be good. I'm not sure how personal to be tonight, but I was pretty straight as a young person. In fact, I took the church most seriously. Honor thy father and thy mother, I took so seriously that my father dominated my thinking. He ruled out 4 marriages that I was about to get into. I mean, 4 times I was either engaged or practically so. Didn't have his okay. And then finally, in what he, before he passed away, said was the worst thing he ever did in his life, he encouraged me to marry somebody, and he didn't even know her. And I married her. I was his obedient son. I can't justify that. I'm not saying it was all his fault. I'm saying it was a tragic thing. It was a marriage without meaning. And then I did something. While the church, well, being a minister, I knew immediately I'd done the wrong thing. But I couldn't get out of it, I felt. I was a minister. The church didn't have any place for single people, certainly not for single ministers, and far less place for a divorced single minister. So I stayed married, and then when the first child was conceived, I said, I have to stay married. I can't desert my child. And I had 3 children and stayed married until I got custody of my 3 children. Then I'm divorced. Well, the church has changed. Now, getting back to what Polly mentioned about some scripture, there is scripture. And I think what it's condemning is the same thing I'm condemning by its understanding of fornication. But let me remind you, it's not a set of rules. And even a literalistic interpretation of the scripture is not enough. For if you believe that, then you will never condone divorce. Jesus himself has words against divorce. I'm not saying divorce is good. I'm saying that sometimes it is a choice that a Christian can make.
Well, I've talked too much. I'll say a couple more things that I've learned and then wait and see if you want to say any more about Christian ethic. Marriage doesn't make sex right, and singleness doesn't make it wrong. The church needs to accept singles and divorcees. I think I'll save the rest in case there's a question.
Okay. First, thank you to each of you four for being very vulnerable here, and appreciate that. I'd like to open it up to the larger group for comments, reactions, answers, your own questions and answers, and encourage you to risk as much as you would like to as well. So.
Di, you talked about your sister's pain, but you didn't really specify what was your pain, if you're willing to talk about that.
Pain. I think getting in too far and having a sexual relationship with somebody, it's just too close. And then without the commitment, I guess, for me personally. And in that separation of that relationship, there's a lot of pain.
Is how is it that a sexual relationship and commitment seem to go hand in hand? From a very pragmatic standpoint, it makes sense that if you're going to procreate, you're going to have some sort of commitment to raising your offspring from a biological reproductive standpoint. But I'm wondering if there's something more that brings us to draw sexual action with a commitment. It always seems to me that when I see people who are quite promiscuous, that have no concept of commitment, or not concept, but have no desire for commitment in their relationships, yet still have sexual relationships with other people, I see them as very sort of power-hungry people, also in a sense of being very alienated people. And also I find that people who have a real sense of desire for intimacy, and I don't mean sexual intimacy necessarily, but intimacy in the sense of vulnerability, that those people that choose to go into expressing sexual behavior tend to do so with a sense of maintaining them. What I'm wondering, is it mutually exclusive to have that? Must they belong together? Is there a reason, I'd like to get some understanding as to how it is that commitment and sexual activity seem to be brought together in our society as the right thing to be.
Anybody want to respond to John?
Marjorie,
go ahead. I'm not exactly certain what you're saying, but if I understand, the question is why does commitment go along with being sexual?
Yeah.
Well, to me, I wouldn't want to have sex with someone that I didn't trust and didn't love and didn't want to have a long-term relationship with that person. And that means a commitment. Otherwise, to me, it just, you know, there wouldn't be that much to it. It would just be a But the other way, it becomes a union of how I love that person and hopefully how he is able to love me back. So it's just trust and respect and love.
Don't you suppose a lot of it has to do with where we've come as far as we were talking about those of us who are older that have been brought up with a different set of a different propaganda, as it were, on the rightness or the whether you had choices or not. And if you come out of that kind of thinking, where commitment was very, very necessary, and you had to be married to make it okay, that out of that, the roots of it being there, it's not going to spring forward and be like a handshake for most people. If we didn't have that cultural background, if we came out of where that was a casual thing, then I think we would not be quite as connected with commitment and sexual expression as being linked.
Along that line, I think it needs to be a personal choice, that there are some clues along the way that are helpful, and the Christian community ought to help all of us in making these decisions. However, it has to be your decision, each person's decision, and the two persons involved must be together on that decision.
You see, I think one of the things that has come to my mind that is quite troubling is a whole handbag of ifs when you look at commitment. In a marriage, if you don't maintain faithfulness, then you've done something very, very wrong. If you have a sexual activity with somebody else and don't have expectation of commitment, then you've done something wrong. Or if you've begun to be sexually active with somebody else and then you go separate ways, you've done something wrong. Labeling as if your action has now denigrated you as a person, that your worth is now decreased. And to me, the focus on commitment has now shifted to that sort of a value system instead of focusing on some of the things that you mentioned in terms of reverence for another person and love and trust. I think love and trust don't necessarily have to do with an intention of how you're going to feel towards this person tomorrow, but it has to do with where you are with that person right now. And so this object of commitment sort of tries to put a qualification on the future, which you may have absolutely no control over. And it seems to me that's where this focus has started to shifting, and I guess that's where a lot of my confusion comes from, is it's defocused it off of the reverence that you speak of, the love and the trust that you speak of, and put it more onto making sure that you got your ducks in line for tomorrow.
Any responses to that?
I don't think that this is anything new.
I had to make sure ducks were in line.
I mean, there's not a switch. It's the same as it's always been.
Is that reassuring, John?
So the human condition's been the human condition, what you're saying.
Go ahead.
But it's whether a set of rules, internally you use them to condemn yourself, or whether through Christ's great love in your heart, you see the larger picture. That's where the focus needs to be on Jesus. Whatever we do, however we interpret the Bible or choose which scriptures we choose, through the guidance of the Holy Spirit, that's where the essence of everything is. And through that, each individual concentrating on becoming closer to Christ, then the church will grow in a healthy direction. And these groups are wonderful, but don't end it here. You know, just keep asking the Lord what's right for you. Keep seeking His rule for your life and your relationships, both you and your dear one, and things will move in a positive direction for us now.
Thank you.
At the danger of talking too often, I believe very strongly in the words of one minister who said, there are no Christian actions, there are only Christians acting. And this is why I believe that for one couple, commitment must be prerequisite. For another couple, it has the meaning that you and I have expressed. That there is affection, there is friendship, there is meaning, a shared meaning in caring and loving. But there's not one ethic for all Christians.
Any other questions or responses to anything that's been said this evening or something that's on your mind? Yeah, Rich.
I think something we haven't talked about that I find real interesting is University of Minnesota's Department of Human Sexuality has been doing studies for years on a lot of facets of this. And one of the interesting ones has been their behavioral medicine studies on psychic patterning. And essentially, some of the conclusions they've come around to have been that sexual learning and sexual satisfaction is directly related to initial and consequent sexual experiences. As far as the learning, the patterns that are developed, the habits that are developed, the experience that is psychically that are related to the sexual encounters. And the part of the things that I've heard were examples such as sexuality is something like tennis, in the sense that if you want to be a good tennis player, you don't just go out and start batting it around. You start right away by taking lessons from a pro who teaches you correctly. If you go out and bat it around and learn bad habits initially, you can be cursed the rest of your life with those bad habits and never become good. Or you can work extremely hard to correct them, but they'll always haunt you. And what they've been saying is that those same things happen in your sexual behavior. That you develop psychic habits and patterns that relate to your sexual behavior. And that they found that people who have multiple sexual relationships, psychically, the next time they get in bed with somebody, they bring with them everybody they've slept with, and they're all in that bed together. And when you start compounding some of that that kind of stuff, pretty soon you've got a couple hundred people in bed with you and you don't know who you're having sex with. So I, you know, I hope that clarifies it.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. Now what
is it? I think I tend to believe this is pretty solidly done, well worked out research, and some of the things that they talk about is that sexually promiscuous people and work that they've done with prostitutes and so forth have pretty well confirmed that there's a gross amount of confusion after a certain point of contact and volume of encounter.
So what's your implication for single people?
Or married people?
Are you making one?
Or can somebody,
you don't make implications? You have back here.
Well, I think just like what he's talking about, it's kind of turning sex into an act, and for a lot of people, maybe that it's, I mean, it's, they'll do it just for their, you know, for the gain or just because they're going to practice that and get good at it. But for other people, it's more of a response to how you feel about someone wanting to share a certain intimacy. And I'm not trying to make a judgment one way or another, but I think you need to keep in mind that maybe you're not just so worried about your performance or anything like that. I mean, I think in a real sexual encounter, there's, you know, you don't have to be rating each other.
You know, which I have to say, I think the tennis analogy is unfortunate because, I mean, well, just the idea of, all right, that you should have a teacher who's more experienced who's going to show you the ropes. And
the point was that the learning is different, whether it's, you know, in the different ways that it happens. And that the initial experience is probably the most significant in the long-term learning, in the long-term behavior, and in the long-term sense of satisfaction.
So if there's like an incest case or a rape or something initially, you could be screwed up for a long time.
Or forever.
Yeah. Or forever.
Exactly.
But wouldn't it encompass the whole relationship? I mean, if you're talking sexuality, are you talking sexual act or sexuality? I mean, if you're talking about a relationship, and you take the whole relationship to bed with you with all the, if the next people you go to bed with, then I think that how you, if you were raped or something like that, then it'd be that total, hopefully the total experience, how, you know, the act itself and then how it was handled afterwards, it was handled well or badly.
Frank.
And I guess, again, to pick on you, you mentioned prostitutes, and I wonder what that is really saying. I mean, those are not the kind of relationships that we're talking about here, I don't believe. And to compare a prostitute's experiences when we're talking about someone who's going to bed for pay, and how that may affect that person, you know, if that's the kind of study that's being done, I don't see there's quite the relevance to our discussion here of commitment.
Well,
or
I can't give you all the details of the study, but they studied a broad cross-section of people with varieties of promiscuity levels, from total abstinence to prostitution.
Well, I don't think anybody here, I hope not anyway, is suggesting that we be promiscuous.
Yep.
We can go vote or what?
Favor.
Yes, back here.
I guess I'm wondering why you have to draw the line at the actual. I mean, I think for some people, they could approach, quote, sex, and it could be more devastating than other people that, you know, maybe going all the way. And I don't think you can just cut it off at the actual intercourse. I think it's different for different people, and it's more of a personal response is what you need to be careful of, or what you need to respect in another person is, you know, like, you can still hurt somebody by, or it could still be morally bad to not have sex with somebody, but to, you know, just look at them as an object or something like that, whereas somebody who you may not be married to, but you love and you want to share intimacy with, you may have sex with them, and that's a lot healthier, I would say.
Thanks.
I think that there might be a big definition problem between sex and sexuality. And I too was raised like, I don't know what your name is, but...
Howard.
And I don't think a Howard situation is just isolated to people who are 70 years old. I think a lot of people are raised, I shouldn't say a lot, I hope a lot aren't raised to believe that sex is the worst act you could do. Murder is not as bad as sex. And I remember being really, really frightened of it for a long time. And finally trying to break that bad seed in some ways. And it affected everything that I did and perceived and experienced in every relationship. And when I didn't enter into a relationship with someone, it was a big problem. And realizing that I did steer around things for a long time because it was a bad thing. And then I started to understand in some ways that what these folks that I was raised with were telling me was that sex was bad. It had nothing to do with sexuality at all. So we've got a definition problem here.
Thank you. Anybody else? We have about 5 or 6 minutes left, so get your questions in now. Okay, back here.
I think relationships are something that take a lot of time, and the sexual aspect of relationship is just one part. It's a very beautiful part, but I think there's a certain order that things happen within a relationship. Like you say hi to someone maybe before you give them a hug, and that to have a sexual relationship early in a relationship can really hinder a lot of other things that can develop within that relationship, a lot of things that need to happen to make that, give that relationship a good foundation. And that by the time that relationship is ready to have a sexual relationship, they're probably ready to be married. So I guess it's the traditional thought that okay. Why not be married before?
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
I have two comments to make. First of all, I was reading something out of this source I do not remember recently on marriages. And what this gentleman that was up here was saying about the more people you have relationships with, they all go to bed with them. And it was talking, let's say it was an article on marriages, but it said that the more active you have been before marriage, the more you tend to compare your mate to other people rather than to accept them for who they are and their own styles and whatnot. And I think another thing that I would like to say here is this question of the difference between free love and prostitution. Okay. There's a fine line. I think it's more than money that draws a distinction between what happens. But I think that we tend to think of a prostitute as somebody who will have relations easily and they're meaningless. And when we, in a more free situation, get involved in sexual relations, that if we feel there's an emotional bond and a closeness, a friendship, that's part of what separates us from what we see as the promiscuous prostitute. Do you understand what I'm saying? Not really.
John, can you say it in a different word?
I think what's being said there is that in a relationship is when we find a prostitute and a customer, you're looking at zero level of friendship, no level of vulnerability, no level of trust. When you're looking at, say, promiscuous behavior outside of commitment, that's not saying that there isn't a level of trust, a level of love, a level of friendship, and certainly vulnerability.
Okay.
Is that what you were saying? Okay.
Well, I'd like to say, I've seen a tape on it's a videotape done by Genesis in Minneapolis, which is a place for recovering prostitutes. And it's not been released publicly because of some of the misconceptions that they thought the public would get from the tape. And I think that the freeing of prostitution is kind of unfortunate comparison because a lot of it is not, it doesn't have anything to do with relationships or anything because it's much more of a power thing and there's just so many other elements. A lot of the women that were interviewed had been abused as children and they didn't, in their recovery process, there were some real overwhelming kinds of issues that they had to deal with in order to get out of it. And it didn't, it wasn't done for pleasure and sometimes the payment was, there was one woman that was a very, very poor and that was the way she could make more money than she ever dreamed of making. And so there were a lot of other factors involved, and so I don't know if it's really relative to what we're talking about as far as relationships go here. I know for myself, when I hear all this stuff about this research and stuff, I find that I disagree with a lot of it because I think that people that I personally know and that have had more than one partner, I don't find that they bring them all to bed with them. I've talked with women and I was married a long time ago and I don't remember that experience when I was with someone. I mean, that's just, that would feel to me to be real disloyal to the person that I was with. And I don't really remember, exactly what it was like. I never even thought of, my ex-husband's performance or anything. I mean, I just find that real hard to believe that. I mean, I'm sure people do, but I don't think that's been the experience of people that I've known.
Thank you.
Yeah, bring
everyone.
I think maybe an issue here would be to level of activity. Somebody who has had two or three, a few sexual relationships before marriage might not bring as much into it, they might be able to separate them all. I don't know, but just a thought.
Go ahead.
I think that sometimes when you're talking about bringing your other lovers to bed with you, I don't think it needs to always be put on a ranking system and comparing. I think that, for instance, if you were really hurt by a first lover or you jumped into bed and did it for the wrong reasons, things can happen later in bed with the person that you love and have chosen to spend the rest of your life with. Past experiences can block orgasm and change so many different things that you would have been able to do. I don't think it always has to be ranked. I think other things happen internally.
Another thing that could be remembered is, I remember we were taught that if we were to get married, then we're responsible for that person and we're to stay with that person until death do us part, as it says in marriage vows, but in the Word of God. But still, when you're single and out in the world and the Lord has called you to a ministry, Paul mentions it in the Bible, where it says that he wished above all that, concerning that you wouldn't do it because you'd have more time in serving the Lord So really, I as I get older, I realize that maybe that's the reason why some of us don't get married, because, and we still have a full life, you know what I mean? And are happy and, you know, and serve the Lord wherever we are. I believe that what it says in the Word, that maybe we're not all called to be married, you know? I mean, some of us are to be single. It could be that that's the reason why some of us are still single. I don't know. But I do know that it is a... you can still have a fulfilled, happy life and a fulfilled life in just being where the Lord places you, you know, in your work and your recreation time and all. But I still believe that the Lord will give you strength and power to overcome things, that temptations that come along, so that you can live for Christ and not fall into those traps that could lead you astray and bring a reproach to the church. One time I almost got married. I'll explain that just real quick. I was out in California, and I used to stay at this mission, and I met a Spanish girl there. She'd gotten saved at this mission, became a Christian. And so I was going with her for a while, and at the mission we'd go out and eat and things. And then we got kind of where we felt like we were in love, you know. But really, I found out that she had been married before. And so I told one of the Christian men there about it. He was a friend of mine from Seattle, where I went to Bible school. And he told me, he said, you cannot marry that person, because if you do, you'll bring a reproach against the church here. And she'd been married before. So I, when I heard that, then I told her that she couldn't do that. So I never got married. But that was one close call I had, you know. And so, but still, okay. She didn't want it.
We got a close call here right now. How about one more comment? Anybody, one more final question, comment, reaction? Frank.
I guess I would like to say that it's easy to give black and white simple solutions to complex questions. And I would like to see the church become the Church of Jesus Christ and act in the way I believe Jesus Christ would act if he was here with us. And from what I've seen, the church still has a long way to go. It's going to take a lot of work.
There have been a lot of issues discussed throughout the week. We had a session on sexuality, a discussion this afternoon. I'm sure some conversations have been happening around and about. Lots of issues didn't get raised this evening. Lots of issues did, and I appreciate folks' willingness to entertain some conversation together. I hope that you feel challenged. We'll continue some of the conversations as you go on your way into the evening. And again, I appreciate your being here and openness to the discussion and to one another.